good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding.
You're listening to episode 578 of Unwelcome Guests, Disconnecting the Dots. I'm Robin Upton. That title is the title of a book which forms the primary source for Peter Dale Scott's presentation to the Toronto 9/11 hearings 10 years on. That will be our first hour. Then we will continue with an interview of Philip Sheenan about the hidden history of the 9/11 Commission. And we're going to conclude with some more of David Graeber's Debt the First 5,000 Years. Now, I've trimmed a couple of the questions from this presentation. If you'd like to watch the whole video, that's available for download from our webpage, unwelcomeguest.net/578.
Peter Dale Scott held various positions in the Canadian Diplomatic Service for 4 years before entering a career as a professor of English literature at the University of California, Berkeley, a position from which he retired in 1994. He is a poet of high stature and renown, who has made his voice heard in public poetry that Michael Ondaatje, speaking of the book Coming to Jakarta, has described as brilliant and devastating. Another leading Canadian poet, Tim Lilburn, has said of Scott's poetry that it offers a hermeneutic of political history while hovering close to the center of things. Peter Dale Scott is also a distinguished public intellectual, known for his anti-war stance and his criticisms of U.S. foreign policy dating back to the Vietnam era. He is the author of numerous books that have been influential in offering a conceptual vocabulary with which to understand the deep structures and hidden forces involved in such nightmarish aspects of contemporary history as political assassinations, concealed coup d'etat, state-sponsored drug trafficking, and state terrorism. His books on deep politics, including The Road to 9/11, have had a strong impact among those investigating the events of September 11th, 2001. Professor Scott will provide testimony this morning on the history of deep state activities with special reference to 9/11.
Thank you very much, and I want to begin by thanking the organizers of this important event and the way in which it was organized. And I do want to say, as a Canadian, I'm really proud that these things take place in Canada, and I'm glad to be back here to speak to you today. There's now a consensus, even from the staff of the 9/11 Commission, that there's something very wrong with the government story. 9/11 Commission team leader John Farmer has said there was either unprecedented administrative incompetence or organized mendacity on the part of key figures in Washington. Now, the mendacity has come from figures including President Bush, Vice President Cheney, NORAD General Richard Myers, and CIA Director Tenet. They include also President Clinton's National Security Advisor, Samuel Berger, who prior to testifying on these matters went to the National Archives and removed and presumably destroyed key relevant documents. Finally, in his book, John Farmer comes down to endorsing both of his alternatives. Farmer's first alternative of unprecedented administrative incompetence is in effect the explanation offered by the 9/11 report to deal with A, striking anomalies on 9/11 itself, and B, the preceding 20 months during which important information was withheld from the FBI by key personnel in the CIA's Bin Laden unit, the so-called Alex Station. But thanks to the groundbreaking new book by Kevin Fenton, Disconnecting the Dots, we can no longer attribute the anomalous CIA behavior before 9/11 to quote, systemic problems, or what Anthony Summers rashly calls bureaucratic confusion. Building on earlier, I'm going to spend a lot of time on Fenton's book because it goes very deeply into what was wrong with the system before 9/11, and it may sound very narrow to you at first, but I hope to build outward from that to more insight into the larger picture of what I call the American war machine at work. Building on earlier important books by James Bamford, Lawrence Wright, Peter Lance, and Philip Chanoun, Fenton demonstrates beyond a shadow of a doubt that there was a systematic CIA pattern of withholding important information from the FBI, even when the FBI would normally be entitled to it. Even more brilliantly, he shows that the withholding pattern has been systematically sustained post 9/11 through four successive investigations, those of the Congressional Inquiry chaired by Senators Graham and Shelby, still partly withheld, the 9/11 Commission, the Department of Justice Inspector General, and the CIA Inspector General. Most importantly of all, he shows that the numerous withholdings, both pre- and post-9/11, were the work of relatively few people. The withholding of information from the FBI was principally the work of what he calls the Alec Station Group, a group within, but not identical with, the Alec Station Unit, and consisting largely of CIA personnel, though there were a few FBI as well. Key figures in this group were CIA officer Tom Wilshire, discussed in the 9/11 report as John, and his immediate superior at Alec Station, Richard Blee. The post-9/11 cover-up of Wilshire's behavior was principally the work of one person, Barbara Grew, who worked first on the Justice Department Inspector General's investigation of Wilshire's behavior, then was transferred to two successive key positions with the 9/11 Commission staff, where she was able to transfer the focus of attention from the performance of the CIA to that of the FBI. Whether or not Grew conducted the relevant interviews of Wilshire and other relevant personnel, and it appears that she did, Grew certainly drew on them when drafting her sections of the Commission's and Justice Department Inspector General's reports. Grew's repositioning from post to post is a sign of an intended cover-up at a higher level. So, as we shall see, is Wilshire's transfer in May 2001 from CIA's Alec Station to the FBI, where he began a new phase of interferences with the normal flow of intelligence, now obstructing the FBI from within it. The pattern begins with intelligence obtained from surveillance of an important Al-Qaeda summit meeting of January 2000 in Malaysia, perhaps the only such Al-Qaeda summit before 9/11. The meeting drew instant and high-level U.S. attention because of indirect links to a support element, a key telephone in Yemen used by Al-Qaeda, suspected of a role in the 1998 bombings of U.S. embassies. As Fenton notes, the CIA realized that the summit was so important that information about it was briefed to CIA and FBI leaders, Louis Freeh and Dale Watson, National Security Advisor Sandy Berger, and other top officials. This is probably what Berger was trying to cover up when he went to the archives. Yet inside Alec Station, Tom Wilshire and his CIA subordinate, known only as Michel, blocked the effort of an FBI agent detailed there, Doug Miller, to notify the FBI that one of the participants, Khalid al-Mihdar, had a U.S. visa in his passport. Worse, Michel then sent a CIA cable falsely stating that Almeida's travel documents, including a multiple-entry U.S. visa, had been copied and passed to the FBI for further investigation. This was a flat-out lie, and it's quite clear that Wilshire authorized her to send that cable. Alex Station also failed to watch list the participants in the meeting, as was called for by the CIA's guidelines. This was just the beginning of a systematic, sometimes lying pattern, where NSA and CIA information about Al-Nithar and his traveling companion, Nawaf al-Hazmi, was systematically withheld from the FBI, lied about, or manipulated or distorted in such a way as to inhibit an FBI investigation of the two Saudis and their associates. This pattern is a major component of the 9/11 story, because the behavior of these two eventual hijackers was so unprofessional that, without this CIA protection from the Alex Station Group, they would almost certainly have been detected and detained or deported long before they boarded Flight 77 in Washington, and so, I may add, would have been the other hijackers with whom they had been in contact. Fenton concludes with a list of 35 different occasions where the hijackers were protected in this fashion, from January 2000 to about September the 5th, 2001, less than a week before the hijackings. In his analysis, the incidents fall into two main groups. The motive he attributes to the earlier ones, such as the blocking of Doug Miller's cable, was to cover a CIA operation that was already in progress. However, after the system was blinking red in the summer of 2001 and the CIA expected an imminent attack, Fenton can see no other explanation than that, quote, the purpose of withholding the information had become to allow the attacks to go forward, close quote. Wilshire's pattern of interference changed markedly after his move to the Bureau. When in CIA he had moved to block transmittal of intelligence to the FBI, now, in contrast, he initiated FBI reviews of the same material, but in such a way that the reviews were conducted in too leisurely a fashion to bear fruit before 9/11. In fact, the key last event is on September the 10th. Fenton suspects that Wilshire, assisted by his FBI colleague Dino Corsi, anticipated a future review of his files and was now laying a false trail of documentation to neutralize his embarrassing earlier performance. I believe that we must now accept Fenton's finding of fact. Here is the quote from him. It is clear that this information was not withheld through a series of bizarre accidents, but intentionally, close quote. However, I see a different explanation as to what those intentions originally were, one which is paradoxically much simpler, more benign, and also more explicative of other parts apparently unrelated of the 9/11 mystery. Now, I want to focus for a while on the intelligence liaison agreements between the CIA and other foreign intelligence agencies. Initially, I believe Al-Mihdhar and Al-Hazmi were protected because they had been sent to America by Saudi GID intelligence service, admitted under the terms of the liaison agreement between the GID and the CIA. Prince Turki Al-Faisal, former head of the GID, has said that he shared his Al-Qaeda information with the CIA and that in 1997 the Saudis, quote, established a joint intelligence committee with the United States to share information on terrorism in general and on Al-Qaeda in particular. The 9/11 report adds that after a post-millennium review, the Counterterrorism Center, that's Alex Station, intended to proceed with its plan of half a year earlier, quote, building up the capabilities of foreign security services that provided intelligence via liaison. That is to say, the CIA itself was helping other foreign intelligence services via liaison to spy on Al-Qaeda, so that the arrival of al-Mihdhar and al-Hazmi could have been part of a Saudi operation that was at a higher level a CIA operation. This was a Blee specialty. Steve Cole reports that Richard Blee and his superior Kofor Black, excited by the opportunities presented through liaison arrangements, they flew together into Tashkent in 1999 and negotiated a new liaison agreement with Uzbekistan. According to both Cole and the Washington Post, this arrangement soon led via Tashkent to a CIA liaison inside Afghanistan with the Northern Alliance as well. Now, I'm going to speak from my personal experience as a very junior former diplomat. A liaison agreement would probably have required special clearances for those witting to the arrangement and sharing the liaison information. In other words, you agree with the Saudis that what they tell you will not go through the whole of the American government, but will be limited to those designated to be cleared for that intelligence. And I have a little footnote here, which I'm going to share. I myself acquired a special, higher than top secret clearance to access intelligence from NATO, a relatively overt and straightforward liaison. And I was not, because I had that clearance, and I think I'd be breaking a law if I told you what the clearance was. I could not come back to my office and tell it to somebody else in my office because he didn't have the same clearance. So it's obvious to me that that's what's happening here. I'm not explaining away what happened. I'm just showing how it worked bureaucratically, and then we can think about what it meant in terms of the war party that was obviously at work in Washington. So where am I here? This would explain the exclusion of the FBI agents who were not cleared for this information, as well as the behavior of other non-cleared CIA agents who proceeded to collect and disseminate information independently about the two hijackers. Alex Station needed both to protect the double identity of the two Saudis and also to make sure that they were not embarrassingly detained by the FBI. Almost certainly the CIA had relevant liaison arrangements, not just with the Saudi GID in Uzbekistan, but also with the Inter-Services Intelligence, ISI, of Pakistan, of Egypt, and probably Yemen and Morocco. In particular, there is reason to think that Ali Mohammed, the double agent who was protected by the FBI from being detained in Canada, thus allowing him to help organize the Al-Qaeda embassy bombings of 1998, was permitted under such arrangements to enter the U.S. as an agent of foreign intelligence, probably Egyptian. According to Mohammed's FBI handler, Jack Clunan, all the information in the famous presidential daily bulletin of August 6th came from Ali Mohammed, and the PDB itself attributes its key finding to what an Egyptian Islamic Jihad operative, and that's what Ali Mohammed was, told a blank service. Ali Mohammed was definitely EIJ, and this service was probably Egyptian. But when Mohammed, like al-Mihdhar and al-Hazmi, was inappropriately admitted to the U.S., because he should not have been admitted, it was reportedly not by the CIA, but possibly by some other federal agency. This, I suspect, was a Pentagon agency, because from 1987 to 1989, Ali Mohammed was assigned to the U.S. Special Operations Command, SOCOM, in Fort Bragg, the home of the Green Berets and the Delta Force, the elite counterterrorism squad. I will have much more to say about SOCOM. SOCOM, which includes JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Command, has its own intelligence division, and SOCOM is the command that first mounted the Able Danger program to track Al-Qaeda operatives, and then inexplicably shut it down. For this and other reasons, I would suggest reconceptualizing what Fenton calls the anomalous Alec Station Group as an interagency liaison team or teams with special clearances, perhaps centered principally in Alec Station, but involving collaborating personnel in the FBI, such as FBI agent Dino Corsi, about whom Fenton has much to report, and possibly SOCOM. Corsi worked at FBI HQ, which, as Fenton notes, coordinated liaisons with foreign services. Now, a little background on the Safari Club and William Casey. This will be easy for those of you who've read my book, but Fenton also gets into the same material. These arrangements, these liaison arrangements, in one form or another, dated back at least to the 1970s. Then senior CIA officers and ex-officers, notably Richard Helms, who were dissatisfied with the CIA cutbacks instituted under Jimmy Carter's CIA director, Stansfield Turner, organized an alternative network, the so-called Safari Club. Subordinated to intelligence chiefs from France, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Morocco, and, under the Shah, Iran, the Safari Club provided a home to CIA officers like Theodore Shackley and Thomas Kleins, who had been marginalized or fired outright by CIA Director Turner. As Prince Turkey later explained, the purpose of the Safari Club was not just to exchange information, but to conduct covert operations that the CIA could no longer carry out in the wake of the Watergate scandal and subsequent reforms. In the Afghan covert war of the 1980s, CIA Director William Casey made key decisions in the conduct of that war, not with his own CIA bureaucracy, but together with the Saudi intelligence chiefs, first Kamal Alam and then Prince Turkey. Among these decisions was a key one, the creation of a foreign legion to assist the Afghan Mujahideen in their war. In other words, the creation of that support network, which since the end of that war we have known as Al-Qaeda. Casey worked out the details with two Saudi intelligence chiefs and also with the head of the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, BCCI, the Saudi-Pakistani bank in which Adam and Turkey were both shareholders. In so doing, Casey was in effect running a second CIA, building up the future Al-Qaeda in Pakistan with the Saudis, even though the official CIA hierarchy in Langley quite rightly thought this unwise. In American War Machine, I situate the Safari Club and BCCI in a succession of second CIA or alternative CIA arrangements dating back to the creation of the Office of Policy Coordination, OPC, in 1948. Fenton himself invokes the example of the Safari Club in proposing the possible explanation that Blee and Wilshire used a parallel network to track Al-Mihdhar and Al-Hazmi inside the United States. In Fenton's words, quote, "Withholding the information about Al-Mihdhar and Al-Hazmi only makes sense if the CIA was monitoring the two men in the U.S. itself, either officially or off the books. But a third option would be that the GID was monitoring their movements, a situation quite compatible with Saudi Prince Bandar's claim that Saudi security had indeed been actively following the movements of most of the terrorists with precision. Joseph and Susan Trento heard from a former CIA officer, once based in Saudi Arabia, that both Hazmi and Mihdhar were Saudi agents. If so, they were clearly double agents, acting or posing as terrorists at the same time they were acting or posing as informants. In espionage, double agents are prized and often valuable, but to rely on them, as the example of Ali Mohammed illustrates, can also be very dangerous. This was particularly the case for the CIA with respect to Saudi Arabia, whose GID supported al-Qaeda energetically in countries like Bosnia in exchange for a pledge that al-Qaeda would not interfere with the politics of Saudi Arabia or any Arab country. Pakistan's ISI was even more actively engaged with al-Qaeda, and some elements of ISI were probably closer to the ideological goals of al-Qaeda than to those of Pakistan's nominally secular government. But in all cases, the handling of illegal informants is not just dangerous and unpredictable, but corrupting. To act their parts, the informants must break the law, and their handlers, knowing this, must first fail to report them, and then, all too often, intercede to prevent their arrest by others. In this way, the handler becomes complicit in the crimes of their informants. Such corruption is very widespread, perhaps inevitable. In the notorious cases of Gregory Scarpa and Whitey Bulger, agents in the New York and Boston offices of the FBI were accused of giving their mob informants information that led to the murder of their opponents. Agents in the New York office of the old Federal Bureau of Narcotics became so implicated in the trafficking of their informants that the whole FBN had to be shut down and reorganized. Even in the very best of circumstances, decisions have to be made whether to allow an informant's crime to go forward or to thwart it and risk terminating the usefulness of the informant. In such moments, agencies are all too likely to make the choice that is not in the public interest. A very relevant example is the first World Trade Center bombing of 1993. Relevant because Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the alleged mastermind of 9/11, was one of the 1993 plotters as well. The FBI had an informant, Emad Salem, among the plotters, and Salem later claimed, with supporting evidence from actual tapes of his FBI debriefings, that the FBI deliberately chose not to shut down the plot. I have two paragraphs summarizing the case. How many people here know a fair amount about the 1993 bombing? Well, I think I'll go ahead and how am I doing on time? Okay, then I will read all of this because I'm going to argue it's extremely pertinent to what went wrong on 9/11. Here is Ralph Blumenthal's careful account in the New York Times of this precursor to the mystery of 9/11. Law enforcement officials, the FBI, were told that terrorists were building a bomb that was eventually used to blow up the World Trade Center, and they planned to thwart the plotters by secretly substituting harmless powder for the explosives, comma, an informer said after the blast, that is, Emad Salim. The informer was to have helped the plotters build the bomb and supply the fake powder, but the plan was called off by an FBI supervisor who had other ideas about how the informer Emad Salim should be used, comma, the informer said. Well, I'll skip the second paragraph. But anyway, as you know, there was an explosion, and only six people were killed, but more than 1,000 were injured, and there were damages in excess of $500 million. That is not a small event, and if the bomb had been placed in a slightly different place, there was a chance that it could have caused damage to the World Trade Center comparable to what happened in 2001. What makes the 1993 bombing even more relevant is that Salim, according to many sources, was an agent of the Egyptian intelligence service sent to America under liaison to spy on the actions of the Egyptian blind Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman. This raises the possibility that the FBI supervisor who had, quote, other ideas about how to use Emad Salim was a member of the liaison team with special knowledge he could not share with other FBI agents. It may have been, for example, that the Egyptian intelligence service simply declined to let Salem's cover be blown. This speculation is both speculative and problematic, but it has the advantage of offering a relatively innocent explanation for otherwise baffling behavior. This explanation does not at all rule out the possibility that some officials had more sinister motives for allowing the bombing to take place and covering it up afterwards. Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman was at this very time a key figure in a sensitive Saudi program signed on to by U.S. officials as well of supplying Mujahideen warriors in Bosnia against Serbia. There's not been much publicity about this, but I have an article on this very subject went up on the web a couple of months ago. You can get it through my website by Googling for Peter Dale Scott and Bosnia, and you will find it. It is clear from both investigative and prosecutorial behavior that a number of different U.S. agencies did not want to disturb Rahman's activities. Even after Rahman himself was finally indicted in the 1995 conspiracy case to blow up New York landmarks, the U.S. government continued to protect Ali Mohammed, a key figure, perhaps the key figure, in that conspiracy. Worse, the performance of the FBI in allowing the bombing to proceed was only one of a series of interrelated performances climaxing with 9/11. The first was in connection with the murder in New York of the Jewish extremist Meir Kahan. The FBI and New York police actually detained two of the murderers in that case and then released them, allowing them to take part in the World Trade Center bombing of 1993. A key trainer of the two men was Ali Mohammed, whose name was systematically protected from disclosure by the prosecuting attorney, Patrick Fitzgerald. Then in 1994, when Ali Mohammed was detained in Vancouver by the Canadian RCMP, the FBI intervened to arrange for Ali Mohammed's release. This freed Mohammed to proceed to Kenya, where he became the lead organizer of the 1998 embassy bombing in Nairobi. Following this atrocity, Ali Mohammed was finally, belatedly detained by the Americans, but still not indicted. He was apparently still a free man when he readily confessed to his FBI handler, Jack Clunan, that he knew at least three of the 9/11 hijackers and had helped instruct them in how to hijack airplanes. we have to conclude that there is something profoundly dysfunctional going on here, and has been going on since before 9/11, indeed under both political parties. The conditions of secrecy created by special liaison clearances have not just masked this dysfunctionality, they have, I would argue, helped to create it. The history of espionage tells us that secret power, when operating in the sphere of illegal activities, becomes time after time antithetical to public democratic power. Add to these conditions of unwholesome secrecy the fundamentally unhealthy, indeed corrupt, relationship of U.S. intelligence agencies to those of Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. This has been profoundly anti-democratic both at home and in Asia. The U.S. dependency on Saudi oil has in effect subsidized a wealth-generated spread of Islamic fundamentalism throughout the world, while what ordinary Americans pay for oil and gas doesn't go into the public treasury, but generates huge sums which Saudis then recycle into the financial institutions, like the famous Carlyle Corporation, at the very pinnacles of Wall Street. In like manner, America's unhealthy relationship to the ISI of Pakistan has resulted in a bonanza in Afghanistan for the international heroin traffic. 93% of the world's heroin now comes from Afghanistan. My book, American War Machine, is very, very interested in that subject. In short, the bureaucratic dysfunction we are talking about in 9/11 is a symptom of a larger dysfunction in America's relationship to the rest of the world. Now I'll talk about liaison agreements and their relevance to the case of Al-Nidar and Al-Hazmi. Even without the suggestive precedent of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, it is legitimate to posit that liaison agreements may have inhibited the roundup of Khalid Al-Nidar and Nawaf Al-Hazmi. Let us consider first Fenton's finding of fact. It is clear that this information about the two men was not withheld through a series of bizarre accidents, but intentionally. This finding I consider rock hard. But we can question his explanation that, quote, the purpose of withholding the information had become to allow the attacks to go forward. I believe that, in fact, there are a number of possibilities about the intention, ranging from the relatively innocent, the inhibitions deriving from a liaison agreement, to the nefarious. Before considering these, let us deconstruct the notion of letting the attacks go forward. Clearly, if the hijackers were not detained at the airport gates, people would have been killed. But how many? Recall that in the Operation Northwoods documents, the Joint Chiefs wrote, quote, we could develop a communist Cuban terror campaign, close quote, in which, quote, we could sink a boatload of Cubans, close quote. Would the loss of four plane loads of passengers have been a qualitatively different tragedy? Of course, 9/11 became a much greater tragedy when three of the planes successively hit the two powers and the Pentagon. But I suspect that their liaison minders of the two Saudis did not imagine, any more than we can imagine, that their targets were capable of such a feat. Recall that their flying lessons, even in a Cessna, were such a fiasco that the lessons were quickly terminated. Their instructor told them that, quote, flying was simply not for them. And they ended up not being pilots, but so-called muscle hijackers. Let me suggest that there are three separable ingredients to the 9/11 attacks: the hijackings, the strikes on the buildings, and the unexpected and unexplained collapse of the three WTC buildings. it is at least possible that the Alex Station liaison team, as a group, never contemplated more than the first. The video of the South Tower attack, in which Flight 175 does not even begin to slow down, persuades me that this flying feat was achieved by robotics. The robotics engineers, and I may disagree with David on this, need not be American. They could be from any group or country, though I do very much doubt that Al-Qaeda had a robotics command in the caves of Tora Bora. A minimal, least malign initial explanation for the withholding of information about two of the hijackers would be the hypothesis I proposed in the case of Ahmad Salim, the constraints established by a liaison agreement. But just as in 1993, the secret power created behind the wall of restrictive clearances may have been exploited for ulterior purposes. The dangerous situation thus created of potential would-be hijackers being protected from detention at a time of expected attack may have inspired some to exploit it as a pretext for war. One clue to this more sinister intention is that the pattern of withholdings detailed by Fenton is not restricted exclusively to the two Saudis and their CIA station handlers. There are a few concatenating withholdings, above all the Able Danger info at SOCOM and an important intercept, apparently by NSA, of a call between hijack organizers KSM and Ramzi bin al-Shib, apparently about the hijackers and also Mousawi. Now, if the NSA was withholding information from relevant audiences, it would recall the role of the NSA at the time of the second Tonkin Gulf incident in August 1964. Then, the NSA, at a crucial moment, forwarded 15 pieces of SIGINT, signals intelligence, which indicated, quite falsely, that there had been a North Vietnamese attack on two destroyers. At the same time, the NSA withheld 107 pieces of SIGINT, signals intelligence, which indicated, correctly, that no North Vietnamese attack had occurred. NSA's behavior at that time was mirrored at the CIA. Both agencies were aware of a powerful consensus inside the Johnson administration that had already agreed on provoking North Vietnam in hopes of creating an opportunity for military response. We know from many accounts of the Bush administration that there was also another powerful pro-war consensus within it, centered on Cheney, Rumsfeld, and the so-called cabal of PNAC, the Project for the New American Century, that before Bush's election had been lobbying vigorously and publicly for military action against Iraq. We know also that Rumsfeld's immediate response to 9/11 was to propose an attack on Iraq, and that planning for such an attack was indeed instituted on September the 17th. It is worth considering whether some of those protecting the hijackers from detention did not share in these warlike ambitions. And this leads us back to Kevin Fenton's prime suspect, Richard Blee. Did Richard Blee have an ulterior motive for withholding information? As Fenton speculates, one of those seeking a pretext for an escalated war against Al-Qaeda was Richard Blee. He definitely was Richard Blee. We saw that Blee, with Kofor Black, negotiated an intelligence-sharing liaison agreement with Uzbekistan. By 2000, SOCOM had become involved, and U.S. Special Forces began to work more overtly with the Uzbek military on training missions. In the course of time, the Uzbek liaison agreement, as we saw, expanded into a subordinate liaison agreement with the Northern Alliance, Blee, meeting with Massoud, agreed to lobby in Washington for more active support for the Northern Alliance. And he became a clique of a party inside the government and even inside CIA that wanted this more active program, whereas other people in the CIA were opposed to it. After the Cole bombing in 2000, Blee was pushing to expand the mission still further into a joint attack force in conjunction with the Northern Alliance forces of Massoud. There was considerable objection to this while Clinton was still president, largely on the grounds that Massoud was known to be supporting his forces by heroin trafficking. If I had all day to speak to you, I would be saying much more about narcotics in the background of 9/11. You may know it's my thesis that there's narcotics in the background of every significant deep event, of which 9/11 is one. But in the spring of 2001, a meeting of department deputies in the new Bush administration revived the plans of Black and, may I add, Richard Clark, who was one of these pro-war activists, for large-scale covert aid to Massoud. On September the 4th, 1 week before 9/11, the Bush cabinet authorized the drafting of a new presidential directive, NSPD 9, authorizing a new covert action program along these lines in conjunction with Massoud. Blee was no longer a minority voice, and 6 weeks after 9/11, he would be named the new CIA station chief in Kabul. Fenton reports that in this capacity, Blee became involved in the rendition of Al-Qaeda detainees, and he suggests that the motive may have been to obtain, by torture, a false confession by Ibn Shaykh al-Libi, the first man to be so tortured, to Iraqi involvement with Al-Qaeda. This false confession by al-Libi then formed a key part of Secretary of State Colin Powell's embarrassing presentation to the UN before the invasion of Iraq. Next question. Did SOCOM have an ulterior motive for closing down Able Danger? What ensued after 9/11? Oh, dear. Oh, dear. You said I had plenty of time. I don't. I don't. All right, I'm going to have to radically abbreviate this. What ensued after 9/11 went far beyond Blee's program for paramilitary CIA involvement with the Northern Alliance. The CIA component in Afghanistan was soon dwarfed by the forces of SOCOM. George Tenet reported that by late 2001, the U.S. force in Afghanistan consisted of about 500 fighters, including 110 CIA officers, 316 Special Forces personnel, that's SOCOM, and scores of Joint Special Operations Command raiders creating havoc behind enemy lines. They were SOCOM, too. In the Bush administration, Stephen Cambone, who earlier had collaborated with Rumsfeld and Cheney in signing the PNAC statement, Rebuilding America's Defenses, became one of the most active promoters of using SOCOM special forces to operate covertly against Al-Qaeda, not just in Afghanistan, but, quote, anywhere in the world, which is, in effect, what we have now under our current president. It is possible that anything Blee may have done in Alex Station to prepare the way for 9/11 was only one part of a larger interagency picture in which an equivalent role was played by SOCOM's shutting down of the Able Danger project. This might help explain a handwritten notation around 10 p.m. on 9/11 by Cambone, then a deputy secretary under Rumsfeld in the Pentagon, after a phone call with George Tenet. And it's clear that he's talking about something that no one else has ever talked about. AA-77, three individuals have been followed since Millennium and Cole. One guy is associate of Cole bomber Two entered U.S. in early July. Two of three pulled aside and interrogated. Now, the guy here is probably Al-Mihdhar, and the cold bomber probably Khalid bin Attash, a major al-Qaeda figure connected not just to the cold bombing, but also to the 1998 embassy attacks. One wants to know why Tenet was sharing with a hawk in the Pentagon information that has apparently never been shared by anyone outside the CIA up to that time. And is it a coincidence that Cambone, like Blee, oversaw a program, in this case staffed by SOCOM special operations personnel, that used torture to interrogate detainees in Afghanistan? I want to conclude with a little historical perspective on the dysfunction we have been looking at. In a sense, 9/11 was unprecedented, the greatest mass murder ever committed in one day on U.S. soil. In another sense, it represented a kind of event with which we have become only too familiar since the Kennedy assassination. I've called these events deep events, events with a predictable accompanying pattern of official cover-ups backed up by amazing media malfunction and dishonest best-selling books. A new one just out by a friend of mine, unfortunately. Some of these deep events, like the Kennedy assassination and 9/11, should be considered structural deep events because of their permanent impact on history. It is striking that these two structural events, the Kennedy assassination and 9/11, should both have been swiftly followed by America's engagement in ill-considered wars. The reverse is also true. All of America's significant wars since Korea, Vietnam, Afghanistan twice, once covertly and now overtly, and Iraq, have all been preceded by structural deep events. So you might say that if it was in the cards that we were going to go to war in Iraq, it was in the cards that we were going to have a deep event. In two recent books, I have been reluctantly compelled, against my own initial incredulity, to list more than a dozen significant parallels between the Kennedy assassination and 9/11. Thanks to Kevin Fenton's brilliant research, I can now list a further analogy. The CIA files on Lee Harvey Oswald, more or less dormant for 2 years, suddenly became hyperactive in the six weeks before the Kennedy assassination. Fenton has demonstrated a similar burst of activity in FBI files on the two Saudis in the weeks before 9/11, a burst initiated by Tom Wilshire at a time suspiciously close to when the hijackers settled on a final date for their attack. And in both cases, there were strange delays to leave the files open at the very day of the deep event. America, I argue in my latest book, has become dominated by a war machine in Washington, a war machine that has been building incrementally since Eisenhower warned us about it in 1961. We should see the actions of Wilshire and Blee in the context of this war machine and the secret consensus in 2001, just as earlier in 1964, that had already become settled on the need for further war. And I was going to wind up with something about how America is not as bad as the people at the top of it and how all power corrupts, but I think we'll go to the questions, and I thank you very much.
There's a very pressing last question. Professor Jenkins.
Is there a place in a well-functioning democracy for secret agencies of the order of the CIA? Or put it another way, can you conceive of a way to have effective oversight over these agencies? Is it possible to open up these agencies to some kind of continuous scrutiny? Or is that simply not possible because of the nature of the necessary secretive dimension of their functioning?
Well, it's a very good question. I'm glad you asked it. And I've thought about it a great deal. And like many people, I think we have to make a distinction between the secret collection of intelligence and sharing of intelligence and covert operations. If you go back to the history of the CIA, it was created for intelligence. And then I mentioned, but didn't go into the details, but I do at some length in American War Machine. A year later, separately, you had the creation of the so-called Office of Policy Coordination, OPC. That was a covert operations agency, which is, I would say, the number one source of the terrible problems that American foreign policy has got. My whole book is a tracing of how this led to the building up, not just collaboration with, but the building up of the narcotics traffic in first Southeast Asia, and then in Laos, and then eventually in Afghanistan. It's all the heirs of the OPC, including a man most of you haven't heard of, Colonel Stilwell, who together with Ted Shackley, who was a disciple of one of the lead OPC people, they helped set up JSOC in what is now SOCOM. And SOCOM, I think, is more dangerous now than the CIA, and is actually writing books against the CIA as being too namby-pamby, etc. I think that there is no compatibility between secret covert operations and democracy. I think there is compatibility with intelligence that goes, it's always dangerous. Anything secret is dangerous. And the trouble is that I wish that Eisenhower, in his famous warning about the military industrial complex, had said the military intelligence industrial complex, and I think he would have nailed the danger a little more precisely. Many people have said, I mean, it was the whole thrust of the Church Committee, that we have something really very dangerous here. And there have been attempts to reform it. I actually think most of the church reforms were converted into things which built up the war machine rather than restricted it, because if you read the accounts of the secret covert war in Afghanistan in the 1980s, one of the lead persons pushing for more money than the CIA wanted was Representative Wilson, sitting on the House Intelligence Committee, which, thanks to the Church Committee, had oversight over what they were doing. And this really meant that the CIA now had a group inside, so that the Intelligence Committee represented the CIA in Congress. It didn't represent Congress in the CIA. But that's just a reflection of the realities that secret power grows and grows and grows and corrupts and corrupts. I could give you another 30 minutes on this, but I think it's time to stop.
Yes. Judge, one last quick question.
The last one, please. Thank you very much, Professor Scott. But I would like only if you can tell the source of your precise and precious information, the source that you gave us.
Very simple answer. Kevin Fenton's book, Disconnecting the Dots. And okay. I hope it is widely read and translated into many languages. It's one of the most important books to come out on 9/11, I believe. And as I say, brought out by somebody who is British writing in Prague, and he was able to... He didn't do it alone. He's building on the work of Paul Thompson and the Terror Timeline people. He thanks Eric Larson. There's about five people. It's a testament to the efficacy of collaborative, open research shared on the Internet. It is a fruit of the Terror Timeline, but it's invaluable, and I think puts us in a whole new relationship to understanding what happened and the events leading up to 9/11.